Alrighty, we are back for another exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio. I'm the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon, and it's an absolute honor to welcome back Dacre Stoker. How are you?
Jimmy, thank you for having me on Cloverleaf Radio. You know, it's the Irish in me that gets me attracted to anybody who talks about the clover. And one of the cool things since we've chatted last is the Bram Stoker Festival is going to be going on in Dublin, Ireland, after all, October. Halloween week in October, and I've been invited to come over and talk all about things that I do for the Bram Stoker Estate and the 125-year anniversary. I'm giving them all kinds of cool information. But more recently, let's say, next weekend, I'm coming to Champaign, Illinois to do very much the same thing. It's talking at the Dark History and Horror Con all about the 120th anniversary of Dracula, many secrets that I've unearthed over the last few years. I do these in presentations, audiovisual presentations, and I think that when Brian invited me to come to Dark History and Horror Convention, I thought, this thing is tailor-made for Dracula. I mean, it's all about history. It's about darkness. So I'm really excited to be heading out there and to be talking to you, Jimmy, about all this.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it over history, who's probably killed some of the most people? It's probably Dracula.
Either Dracula or Vlad the Impaler, you know, which are all intertwined and connected, aren't they? I call it the inseparable connection between Vlad Dracula and Count Dracula. They got a pretty good body count, wouldn't you think?
No, absolutely.
In history and in horror, you know, it's the perfect match.
Absolutely. I did read the other day that you have thoughts that Bram believed that could have been a real Dracula, maybe possibly besides Vlad.
Just trying to put that in context. So let me say this. I understand from my research that Bram found at least 13 countries where people in those countries believe that vampires had existed.
Wow.
I don't know if they were actually called Dracula. What I'm pretty sure of, Jimmy, is that he found the name Dracula in two books during his research, one in the London Library and one in the Whitby Library, and they both pointed the finger at somebody who wasn't a vampire, which is Prince Vlad Dracula of Wallachia, which was right next door to Transylvania. Bram, however, found these books and other books showing a very colorful, dark history, brutality, all kinds of horrifying things that were done in the 14th, 15th, and 1600s, and many of them attributed to Mr. Dracula's family, his father, himself, Vlad, his brother, their ongoing fights with both the Ottoman Empire as well as the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. They were like stuck in the middle of two superpowers, and they were always fighting just to keep their head above water. So Bram used Vlad Dracula as a perfect model to turn into this supernatural creature that he needed, sort of a real history. You know, he wanted to make him seem real. Not that other people, you know, didn't think the vampires potentially were real, but when he attached him to the history of a real person, that had a real history and background of being bloodthirsty and so on, it was the perfect match. And that's maybe where it all, you know, kind of congealed together.
Yeah, it's always amazed me where people find inspiration for these characters. And how real and truthful a lot of things can be in a fake character. It can be scary.
Well, that's the whole point, and that's what I go into great detail in my presentations, is what events in Bram's life that were real, and real people that he knew, real events that he borrowed and put into Dracula, which of those things were woven into the fabric of the novel to make the novel feel much more realistic. I mean, he wrote the book between 1890 and 1897, not long after the Jack the Ripper murders were terrorizing London, scaring the heck out of his future readers. And just a couple of years later, he brings a supernatural power, this vampire lord from Transylvania, which was, you know, a little off the grid, but still not too far away, to the shores of England, lands in Whitby and then infiltrates London before the band of heroes chase him back. But he placed the story in 1893, and he placed everything in a very realistic scenario. The London Zoo, places outside suburbs where the Count put his 50 boxes of dirt, Carfax Abbey, and he used Purfleet and Exeter, Highgate Cemetery, Hendon Cemetery, kind of merged together to be the place where Lucy's crypt was. Hillingham, these different estates, were all kind of merged in somewhat real places, based on real things. And that's what I think made the story, as you just said, feel that much more just bloody scary, because people thought it was real.
Absolutely. Now, I was not aware there was a big issue with the Dracula copyright. I would always assume that being it was written so long ago that there would be, like, no copyrights left on a public domain kind of thing. Can you go into the issues with the Dracula copyright?
Well, yeah, in 1962 it went public domain. 50 years after Bram Stoker died, it was public domain. The movie rights had been sold back in 1930. The dramatic rights were protected by Bram, and his widow profited from those, selling them to different playwrights, Hamilton Dean, John Balderston. But one of the things that is probably an interesting urban legend that I go into much more detail in my presentations is that Bram did not file the copyright properly in the U.S. And that's a fairly complex process. But Bram was a legal man. He was a clerk in the Petty Sessions legal department. He was the inspector later on of all clerks all over Ireland. He wrote a whole book, a legal manual. So it was really strange that these biographers said he didn't file the copyright procedure in America correctly. He had come to America 8 times to the Lyceum Theatre. He had to know all the legalities of import and export and bringing in laborers. Well, I found it strange, and I contacted the Library of Congress, and luckily they had a lady there, Margaret Wood, who was equally as amazed that the possibility this existed. And she did some digging, and she found that there was a slight filing error on somebody on their behalf way back in 1897. And it was funny because somebody had written in these cards that you have to put in once all the paperwork's done, and you have to bring in 2 different books. And they listed under Bram Stoker, and then Abraham Stoker. Abraham was his formal name. Bram was his shortened pen name. And so because they got it slightly wrong, there was this confusion. And certain biographers, said that he had only given one book or didn't do it right. In fact, she wrote a blog post about it a few years ago and cleared up totally that he did do it right. So we could put that to rest. As far as the copyright goes, it is the public domain. The American copyright was filed properly. But the only other cool thing is, and again, I go into detail of this, and I will in Champagne at the Dark Horror and History Con, that the movie Nosferatu was actually a copyright infringement, that they actually did not approach Bram Stoker's widow and get permission or get a license to adapt Bram's story, Dracula, into the movie Nosferatu. And she started a lawsuit against him with the help of the Independent Author Society in England. And it took 2.5 years, but she prevailed. So there is a lot of legal entanglements, but I've really taken it upon myself to try to get as much information as I can to kind of clear it up so people get it. And as I said, I'll be going into more detail and showing these actual cards and these filing cards on my screen to kind of give all the good detail. And it's pretty especially cool because this is the 100th anniversary of Nosferatu and the 125th anniversary of Dracula. It's the right time to clear up all these misnomers.
Oh, absolutely. Have you done a lot of conventions and presentations and things like that over the years?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I like it. I love to meet the fans face to face. I've traveled many countries all over the world when my different books have come out, Dracula the Undead, in 2009 and Dracula in 2018, you know, published over, you know, 20 countries each one. So I'm always being asked to go over, talk about the background of not only Bram Stoker, his research, his writing, but what I had written with my co-authors, and where did we get the information from. So I love to do that. Having been a former teacher, I love to stand in front of a crowd and give them the skinny and all this stuff, and then meet people at my table and talk and sign books and sign autographs. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, definitely. I've been involved with Brian since, gosh, 2015, and everybody there is just really awesome. It's become like a family. So I think you're going to really enjoy yourself.
Well, I look forward to it. And when I met Brian in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he, you know, said, hey, think about us, I said, well, I'm already there, man. Just tell me when the dates are, and let's make the arrangements. Because, you know, dark history and horror are the perfect combo for Bram Stoker, Dacre Stoker, and family to spread the word. So really looking forward to it.
Very cool. Well, I found it, I'm not sure if we talked about this the last time, but I found it interesting that you're a former member of the Canadian men's pentathlon team, which I'm not even sure what that is, but you also coached the team at the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul, South Korea. What is pentathlon, and what was it like being at the Summer Olympics in 88?
Well, I'll give you the short version of this, but modern pentathlon is the modern version of the pentathlon. There was an ancient one back in the ancient Olympics that involved wrestling and javelin throwing and discus, and, you know, all these things that were involved in, you know, ancient warfare, running, short distance, sprinting, all that. The modern pentathlon was invented by Pierre de Coubertin in the early 1900s, and he utilized the attributes of the military couriers, or the modern man of warfare at the time: ride a horse, sword fight, shoot a gun, swim, and run. And I saw that sport at the Montreal Olympics, where I was actually working as a just graduated from high school, and I was working there as a drug tester for the equestrian events, you know, it's just an attendant. I thought, this is pretty cool. I can already do a couple of these things. I could already ride horses and jump pretty well, and I could run and swim. I didn't know anything about fencing or actually shooting rapid-fire pistol. So I went on the fast track to learn this stuff, and I got pretty good at it and managed to be in position to make the Canadian team in 1980, but there was a boycott because that's the games were held in Moscow. So I, you know, put my head back down again and tried to train like crazy, and I couldn't do enough training for 84 because I'd already started working as a teacher, and that just cut into all the necessary training. So I devoted myself to becoming a coach, and I coached the Canadian ladies team for 4 years at World Championships. We actually won a World Championship in 83, and really that kind of got me the job to help the men's team get ready for the 1988 Olympics. And a lot of these were guys that I had trained with in the past. I had a good familiarity with them and good rapport. So I helped them, and we ended up qualifying for the 88 Olympics and went to Seoul, South Korea, and actually finished in the top half for the first time ever in the Olympic field. So yeah, a lot of fun, and managed to travel around the world. A lot of tension, intensity. And just some of this was before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I've got to travel to communist countries that were pretty rough. But also, you get treated quite well as an athlete and wherever you go. And it shows you, you know, a different perspective on the world of sport when you're competing at that level, which sometimes is a lot of fun, but also it's sometimes a lot of down and dirty.
Oh, I'm sure that is one heck of a sport. Have to do all that. I'm sure it had its challenges and very interesting parts to it.
Absolutely, it has. But, you know, no regrets. But, you know, after about 12 years of that, packed that up and came back home and started raising a family. And still involved in sports, but not at the Olympic level.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you mentioned before we started recording that you have a new book out, and thought I would want you to get into that because I'm sure it's very important, being the 125 year anniversary and everything.
Yeah, I'm really excited to say this for the first time on any podcast. Hellbound Publishing, James Longmire's a friend of mine. He's published some of my other stuff. He's republished the Bram Stoker Lost Journal, which is a work of nonfiction, as well as Slane's Castle Secret History, another nonfiction. And this one, I'm really proud to say, is a work that culminated about a year ago. And it's kind of got a tragic story to it. Robert 18 Pezang, Canadian Dracula scholar, was one of the two scholars who published the Bram Stoker Dracula notes that were in the Rosenbach Museum. That was a labor of love for him and Dr. Elizabeth Miller, and that brought the world a really interesting look at Bram's creative process by annotating and publishing the facsimile edition of these notes. Well, he contacted me a couple of years ago and said, we need to go a step farther. We need to annotate a Dracula together and utilize these notes, but also the Dracula typescript. The Dracula typescript is the final piece of work that was in Bram Stoker's hands that he handed off to his publisher. There are lots of deletions, edits, additions. That was quite cool. We also had access to something my cousins loaned to me, which is a first edition of Dracula that Bram had crossed out 30,000 words to create the first abridged edition of Dracula in paperback form in 1901. So what we did, Jimmy, is took all of these works and kind of crunched them into an annotated Dracula and have over 1,400 annotations explaining Bram's writing process, but showing things that were left out that people have never seen before, things that were put back in again at the last moment. And that's coming out. So the 125th anniversary of Dracula, the annotated edition of Dracula, should be coming out sometime in the next 2 weeks. I don't think I'll have copies, unfortunately, in my hands at the Dark History and Horror Con, but they will be on my website. I do sell all my books at the BramStokerEstate.com website, sign them, ship them out, and then I will have them at other events as well in a couple of weeks. So really exciting. And the other thing is it's got a wonderful dedication to Robert 18 Pezang. Sadly, he passed away just a couple of weeks after we finished writing the book and working on it and tweaking it. He had a heart attack and went to the hospital for an operation and never came out. So this is dedicated to Robert and all his work in the Dracula world. This is his last piece that I think is going to be his finest piece. And, you know, mine as well when it comes to nonfiction work. So really excited to get this out.
Well, it's unfortunate he passed away, but it sounds like he's leaving a good legacy with you in this book.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that. His legacy will live on through his incredibly astute and detailed work in this book. And people will remember him for the Dracula notes and also remember him for this one as well.
Yeah, that's kind of what we all want, I guess, at the end of the day when we pass on, for some people to remember us and what we did in this life. So,
yeah, and some cool. It's a good work that lives on in these books, and people will pick it up and think of him and think of me and others like Elizabeth Miller. She also passed away during this pandemic, and she left a great legacy behind of Dracula scholarship. So we've lost a couple of them, but it's, you know, guys like myself and others, John Browning, Hans de Roos, you know, others in the field that are keeping this going. Aaron Chapman, you know, keeps a website going. Lots of people trying to keep, you know, Dracula scholarship and serious approach to Dracula fandom alive and well. I think it's in good hands as we go forward into this 125th anniversary of Dracula.
Absolutely. I wanted to congratulate you on Paramount purchasing the rights for Dracula.
Well, I got to tell you something interesting. I appreciate that, but we, unfortunately, after them renewing the option three times, they decided not to. We've actually not to renew it, but I can't give you this news yet. I don't have names yet, but it's back out, and there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of interest for it to come back out, even though Paramount decided not to. And I can tell you this, JD and I are more thrilled with the possibilities going forward now than we were even when Paramount purchased the option. So I can't give you the details, but it's looking pretty good for the future of Dracul coming out to to viewers in a visual medium pretty soon.
That's awesome to hear.
Yeah. I wish I could tell you more, but you know the way it goes.
Oh, yeah, there's always NDAs and can't talk about this and that. And that's understandable because stuff changes all the time in the industry, so can't be mad about that.
Yeah, no, you're right. Absolutely.
Well, what's the future hold for you, Dacre? Of course, we got Dark History and HorrorCon, but you got any other appearances or anything like that you'd like to promote? It was nice to talk to you again.
Oh, boy. Can I remember them all? Michigan Paracon the next weekend. Up in Sault Ste. Marie, the 26th and 27th of August. And then, my goodness, September, I've got a heading out to the West Coast for a swing out there. I know I've got appearances scheduled in Alameda, in Astoria. Where else am I going? I know I've got something in Jacksonville, Florida, the October the 15th. We're going to be in Boston on Tuesday, the 11th of October. And then, as I said earlier in the top of the show, Dublin, Ireland, really excited that the Bram Stoker Festival is back on again, Halloween weekend. And then I've got a presentation I'm doing at Emory University's Rose Library, which is really cool because a friend of mine, John Moore in Ireland, sold his incredible collection, the most extensive collection of Bram Stoker holdings anywhere in the world. He sold them to Emory's University Rose Library, and they now have the most complete edition of all the books Bram Stoker wrote, letters, all kinds of really cool things. And I'm going there in a supportive way to give a presentation to help them kick off a fundraising effort to digitize all this stuff so it's available for scholars all over the world to look at. As nice as it is to go to Atlanta to check out the library, I know what it's like and the expense of what it's like to fly to countries, fly to cities to do your research. So, yeah, that's the 22nd of October in Atlanta, and probably other ones are going to pop up in between. But I'll keep you posted, and we'll do some more chatting as the season goes on. It's always busy for me in the fall, as you can well imagine, in the world of Dracula and horror. But thank you so much for having me on your show, and looking forward to catching up with you in the future.
Yes, it will be nice to meet you in person next weekend, and I enjoy you coming on again, and thanks for everything, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
All right, man, same to you, and all your listeners, y'all take care.
All righty, thanks a lot.
Okay, yep, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, guys, big thanks to Dacre Stoker. We got a couple of rescheduled guests coming up, but I don't have dates yet. I need to confirm with Kenny Sills because we had to reschedule. We also have to reschedule Peter Jason. So I will let you guys know when those happen. As always, thank you everybody for listening. Have a great night.